I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a walk over to the Wayback Machine and revisit Indianapolis in the 1970s. We're going to take a look at the upcoming Naptown Get Down Bar Crawl. My guests are Ted Franz of the University of Indianapolis' Institute for Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Dan Shockley of the Indiana Historical Society. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about a specific event, the Naptown Get Down 70s Bar Crawl, and we'll talk about that event. More broadly, we're going to talk a lot about what Indianapolis was like in the 1970s, what the big events were, what defined this city and the way people lived at that time. And I might add, even though, you know, this is supposed to be a historical show for some of us, this was not history. It's still current events. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Ted Franz. He is with the University of Indianapolis' Institute for Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Dan Shockley of the Indiana Historical Society. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's good to have you here. So let's start, and I should say to our listeners, I hope you all are staying dry out there right now. It's torrential right here in downtown Indianapolis. Let's start by talking about what the Naptown Get Down 70s Bar Crawl is. Ted, I'll start with you. Or do you want to go with Leah?
Every year, Indiana Humanities does a history bar crawl. So we pick a different historical topic or theme, and then we create a bar crawl around that theme. So this is the fifth year we've done that, and this year our theme is Naptown Get Down. We're looking a groovy, boozy tour through 1970s Indianapolis. And so we work with the Indiana Historical Society to bring those scenes to life in person. We put together thematically appropriate food and snacks and all kinds of other swag and surprises so that you really feel like you're getting a great evening in 1970s Indianapolis. Although we'll talk about 1970s Indianapolis downtown wasn't quite the happening place that it is now in the 1970s. So we actually think we can do a better job than you would have had in downtown Indianapolis 1970s. And Ted Franz is actually one of our board members, but he's also the director of the Mayoral Archives. So he's a great resource for understanding, you know, the politics and economy and culture of Indianapolis in the 70s.
So take me through what the event is going to be like then. You say you've got five stations, basically?
Great. So we do it two nights, and those will be next week, Tuesday, June 20th, and Wednesday, June 21st. And so people will gather at our starting and ending location, which this year is an event space called 416 Wabash. It's got a light-up floor. It's very disco groovy appropriate. And everybody gets to have a drink. We have beer that's been donated by Sun King. And then you'll be divided up into groups, and we have groups that are themed around the 70s. So we have groups called, I think this year we have the Exploding Pintos and the Pet Rocks and a few other things. I'll leave surprises. And then you'll tour to four different sites around downtown. And at each stop, there will be actors bringing to life a real scene from Indianapolis history. We've done lots of research to bring that scene to life. You'll have a snack and a drink. Over the course of the evening, you have five or six drinks. It's a pretty boozy time. Sun King, as well as some specialty cocktails at some of the different stops. And then you also get a chance to go inside some interesting locations that you might not have been to. We take people to a mix of traditional bars, as well as sometimes behind the scenes of places that would surprise you. For instance, last year we were on a rooftop in downtown Indianapolis that's not normally open to the public. So it's a really fun evening. You're done by about 9 p.m. We give you a snack and send you on your way.
Well, before we move into kind of the how you reconstruct the history of this, if people want to participate, yeah, how do they go about doing
great.
That?
Great. So they can visit our website, indianahumanities.org, and right there on the homepage, you'll see a link to information about the bar crawl. You can reserve your ticket ahead of time. Tickets are $60. That includes all your food, drinks, swag, and lots of fun. And you should do that sooner rather than later, especially if you're interested in coming on Wednesday night, which is almost sold out. So we have a pretty hard cap that we have to cap the event at. So please visit our website, indianahumanities.org, to purchase your tickets.
So, Dan, how do you go about creating the historic authenticity of that, keeping in mind things like Sun King wasn't around, obviously, back
sure,
in the night.
But beer and certainly was.
Beer was, but that whole idea of craft beer was still a relatively new phenomenon.
Well, we're very lucky in this partnership because Indiana Humanities takes the lion's share of the research, and they have people who do just tremendous, tremendous amounts of research. And then that's given to me, and then we work with the actors from the Indiana Historical Society's Museum Theater Department to, select key moments out of, what could be, 100 pages of research that we distill down into 5 minutes of good history that people can engage in and really understand the point, but also further their interest in a topic, and maybe they'll explore it further later.
How do you choose, and I'll throw this out to anyone, those moments that you consider emblematic not just of the 70s, but of the 70s in Indianapolis?
Sure. So we start with a pretty broad brush. And so we try to kind of just brainstorm. We talk to smart people like Ted and say, okay, if we're going to do something on the 70s in Indianapolis, what can we not miss? Right. And so we start there. We actually usually do kind of preliminary research on 8 to 10 general topics. I like to look at what was happening nationally. So conversations about women's rights and the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, for instance, was a national conversation in the 1970s. And so then we start to look, what did that look like in Indianapolis? How were Hoosiers engaging? And then we also try to find a balance of topics that are serious and get into real kind of social and political questions, as well as things that are a little bit fun and that make for a good bar crawl stop. So our version of that this year, I think, is the Save the Pacers telethon from the 1970s, which I would make the case is also tied to some big conversations that were happening in Indianapolis about what kind of city are we going to be? And the sports strategy was one, way to revitalize downtown and revitalize the economy. So even though we think of like this kooky, very Hoosier type of thing to do, which is to have a telethon to save your NBA basketball team, it's also tied to some really big ideas about Indianapolis in the 1970s.
So Ted, what, in terms of the seminal events, what ones that when they talked to you, did you first kind of propose?
Well, I mean, the most obvious one is UNIGOV. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't think about modern Indianapolis without UNIGOV, and UNIGOV came into effect as we turned to 1970, January 1st, 1970. That redefined what the city was, not just metaphorically, but quite literally and in a structural way. So that's the first one. And then you start going through. And of course, the great thing is so many of the people who are here for that transformation are still around, and you can talk to them. And, mm-hmm. and certainly then we would mine our documents at the University of Indianapolis, which we've digitized too, right? So you can anybody can get those really easily. And that's a fantastic resource. But UNIGOV would be the first one. And then you start walking through. And Leah already mentioned the sports strategy as a manifestation of this big idea of what do we want Indianapolis to become? Mm-hmm. And for me, there's so many fascinating stories that come of the 70s. And it's that juxtaposition of this moment of creation and coming together in this city, whereas the national narrative tends to be something about falling apart and disintegration. So bringing those together, I think, is just fantastic. And Indian Humanities is so great at doing that for an audience and making it accessible and understandable.
We're talking about the upcoming Naptown Get Down 70s Bar Crawl, which is really an exploration of life in Indianapolis in the 1970s. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can reach out to us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, Or you can do what our regular listener Jerry has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, it was supposed to be partly sunny in Naptown today, but as I write this, it is raining like crazy in Irvington. My contrarian nature prompts me to mention that not all of the changes in the Circle City have been for the good. Concomitant with the rise of sports during the past quarter century, some of us have observed a decline in other aspects of culture. For example, a few of us objected to the expenditure of $750 million of public money for the erection and maintenance of a facility in which 300-pound multimillionaires could play their highly profitable game. Some of us were displeased at the decline of the Indianapolis Symphony and of music and arts education in our public schools, not to mention the ongoing relatively poor performance of those schools. There is a lively and stimulating arts presence in Indianapolis, but it has not been much helped by significant public, that is, local and state government, investment. I beg your panel to prove me wrong. I'll start with Ted on that one.
It's a great point, and I think part of the reason you want to study the 70s with some complexity is to say that whereas you can tell a boosterous narrative, there also is this underside. Mm-hmm. That is a part of the 70s as well. Some groups get included in that rebirth, and some groups get excluded. And that's, as a historian, something that I would be the first to admit. I would point out that we didn't start erecting, as just a technicality, we didn't start erecting those massive stadia until the 1980s, actually. So the 70s were the beginning of that, and I actually think...
Well, but we had Market Square Arena. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And that, I think, is a fascinating one because... Richard Lugar had the foresight to build an arena in downtown at a time when nobody else in the country was doing so. And you can argue everything else, but a lot of the people who settled on the sports strategy, right, would tell you that that wasn't supposed to be the end in itself, that it was part of a three-pronged strategy. Sports got the most momentum, and certainly health sciences and ag, which have kind of eventually caught up a little bit, we're supposed to be part of this triad. So there's a lot to play with there for sure. But again, I think that to build an arena downtown at a time when everybody wanted to get out of cities, that made Indianapolis different. And I think without that, you would have had probably even more just pushing towards the suburb, and you would have had what Bill Hudnut and Dick Lugar all warned about, that you would have a donut. There would be no core upon which you couldn't build schools, arts, or any of those things.
So why the 70s? I mean, given all of the decades, and I'm saying that as someone who came of age during those years. So,
well, I'll start and say that I'm 35, and so my friends who are coming up through graduate school and early career historians, the 70s.
So this really is history for you because you
didn't
experience
any of them.
Well, I will
say it is really history for me, but it's also a really, this is a period that historians are really starting to examine in depth. So people like Ted, who I know your original dissertation was on 1880s political culture, but the 1970s and kind of understanding the political changes that frankly we're still living with and experiencing all the time, this is where the academy is. And, you know, part of our role is to say, okay, let's translate like these big falutin ideas that come out of the academy for regular people. I will also say the 70s are a transformative decade in Indianapolis history. So more so than looking at the 60s or the 80s, to understand Indianapolis today, you have to look at the 1970s. And that's partly because of, you know, the political and economic changes that are happening then. UNIGOV is a great example. I think also looking at, you know, more grassroots debates about what kind of city was Indianapolis going to be. Was it going to be inclusive for African Americans? Was it going to be inclusive for women? This is the birth of the activism in the gay community. So these are all really important changes that are happening in the 70s. And I will say, in addition to all of those things, it makes for some great costumes. The style, the explosion of men's fashion in the 1970s alone makes for a perfect bar crawl. So we really like to play with all of those different elements.
You're being kind. It's really the explosion of the lapels, the explosion
color,
of the
patterns,
cuffs on pants,
hair.
All of
I saw
that
a great graphic about graphing men's hair, facial hair, over the course of the 20th century, and you just see this like crazy spike like in the 1970s of mutton chops and mustaches and beards and all that kind of stuff. So, and beards have come back in a big way. So
right.
maybe it's all on its way.
Well, and the other big thing is the explosion of what I routinely refer to now as the hair helmet. You know, that it, your hair formed what amounted to an organic helmet that
hairspray and environmental degradation in the 70s are probably connected
pretty close
in some way.
Well, except, yeah. We are talking about the 1970s. The specific hook is the upcoming Naptown Get Down 70s Bar Crawl here on No Limits today. My guests are Ted Franz of the University of Indianapolis's Institute for Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives, Leah Namias, she is with Indiana Humanities, and Dan Shockley, who is with the Indiana Historical Society. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indianapolis in the 1970s. The specific hook for our conversation is the upcoming Naptown Get Down 70s Bar Crawl that's going to be next week. If you want to join the conversation, well, I should say my guests are Ted Franz of the University of Indianapolis's Institute for Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Dan Shockley of the Indiana Historical Society. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Denny has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Denny, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hey, if we're talking about the 1970s in Indianapolis, for me, the remembrance is the blizzard of 78. And I lived across the street from the Red Key at the time, the Red Key Tavern, 52nd and College. And Russ kept the bar open because he was snowed in like the rest of us. And it was great. So the neighborhood had a play. Anybody willing to get out and brave the elements to go to the Red Key, which we did. And as I remember, Russ literally, you know, slept on the bar with his pistol in his belt to keep the place safe.
Well, we will deal with what memories we have of the blizzard of 78. I just recall being trapped in a college dorm room for days on end. But thanks very
much. Well, you didn't live across the street from the Red Key.
I did not. I wish I had. But thanks very much for the call and the memory.
We're talking about a bar crawl too. I would hope that, you know, I don't know if the Red Key is on the bar crawl list, but that would have been my recommendation if anybody had asked.
Well, I'm seeing some nods of recognition around here. Thanks very much for the call, Denny.
All right. Thank you
care.
For your show.
Sure.
I love that call for a couple of reasons. So I will say the Red Key is not on the bar crawl because we try to do this in a walkable area. So we're downtown Indianapolis and there's just no...
Or a stumbleable
area. Yeah, stumbleable area by the end of the evening. But you are absolutely right that the 1978 blizzard is one of the iconic events of the 70s. And so my father was trapped at an elementary school in Kokomo, Indiana. His family ran a shoe store there. And so he was for days, you know, stranded in Kokomo. My uncle was a doctor who worked at Community East, and he was stuck there for days. So lots of people have stories of the blizzard of 1978. And I will say we do incorporate the blizzard of 1978. There will be, at the end of the night, a cold treat inspired by all of that snow. But I'll let you figure out what it is. We like to keep some things a surprise. So the blizzard of 1978 will be making an appearance at the bar crawl.
So, Dan, how do you go about, because, you know, obviously Denny's story is one window on that event. A lot of other people have other. How do you go about attempting to create what that experience was like when really it's, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of individual experiences?
That's true. And that's what we try to focus on, though, is someone's individual experience. To talk about something like the Pacers Telethon or the Now movement in Indianapolis, if you try to look at Now as the giant movement over a decade or more, you kind of lose something. But if you focus on one woman, two women's stories, maybe three or four, that makes it more personal and more relatable, I think, for the audience.
Yeah. I would just say on the Blizzard, too. I mean, and that's one of those moments that if you're picking out iconic moments of the 1970s, UNIGOV maybe is a creation thing, but a natural disaster in a landlocked city like that, I mean, this is everybody alive remembers that. And also many of them, even if they didn't directly come in contact with Bill Hudnut, mm-hmm. recognized that this was a point of his leadership where he felt like people felt like he brought them together. So out of this crisis comes this feeling again of people fighting a common cause, in this case, the elements, which has kind of a Midwestern hardiness to it as well. But that is something that rather than people look back on with disdain, mm-hmm. you know, it was terrible to go through, but it became something that even a year out, they were celebrating it as a landmark for the city rather than something to forget, which is remarkable.
Pictures yeah. in the archives of Hudnut holding up a T-shirt that says, you know, I survived the blizzard of 1978, which if you can find one of those and yeah. send one to me, that would be amazing. But I do think, you know, Indianapolis was really blessed with some pretty forward-looking creative leadership in the 1970s. And so seeing how the Hudnut administration responded to this natural disaster, which was the first time the National Weather Service had ever declared a statewide emergency. I discovered this when I was brushing up on the history, you know, to see how they kind of said, oh, and then they invested like $2 million in snow plows, actually, after the blizzard, because they realized they weren't ready if it were to happen again.
Yeah, somehow the phrase barn door after the horses fled seems to be sticking in my head here. We're getting a tweet from a listener named Ross. If you want to reach out to us via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Ross writes, was there a connection to neighborhoods in the 70s as we see in Indy currently? What were the vibrant neighborhoods in the 70s? I'll throw that. Everyone's looking in Ted's direction, so which is the way.
Well, I think when you start talking to people, there was a real tension in the 70s and 80s in particular between the core and the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And there would be a lot of people, like your first email, really, who would probably yeah. point to, hey, a lot of the nearby local communities lost out as more and more focus went to the inner city. And I think that's probably a valid critique because also, right, many of those communities that had a separate identity had just fallen under the big rubric mm-hmm. of Indianapolis because of UNIGOV. So the 70s I look at as really trying to shake all of that out, to be honest. And mm-hmm. and that's one where I think the listeners would have a really good idea of, oh, well, culturally, this was the place to be. And this part of the city was flourishing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the question, I think, of authenticity that Leah alluded to at the beginning when she points out, you know, if this is in downtown Indianapolis, as someone when I came back from grad school who started living and working in downtown Indianapolis, the cliche that they rolled up the sidewalks at 6 p.m., that establish the truth of the cliche at that point. That's how it became. It is nothing like the downtown these days. I mean, it really was, as soon as people were finished working, they left. And it was that simple, and there really wasn't, you know, much vibrancy or whatever. So how do you try to create a sense of something that really wasn't there?
Well, I mean, I should say that we try to balance telling the history with all the practical considerations of moving, you know, 250 people in a walkable distance over a course of 3 hours. And I think there's a lot. I mean, I know one of the challenges of transit planning in this city is the lack of density that is in part related to UNIGOV. So it always goes back to UNIGOV. But, you know, so there aren't a lot of places that have that kind of walkable neighborhood density feel. So we try to take places, people to downtown. I mean, I know one of the things we're going to walk past on our route are one of the urban walls murals from the 1970s. This was an arts-based initiative in the 70s to revitalize, you know, there were buildings that had been torn down, so there were these empty walls around downtown. This was a Luger administration initiative to use art. We tell the sports strategy story. We don't always tell the art strategy story in Indianapolis. So we try to find those kind of icons of the 70s. But, you know, we also kind of balance taking people into maybe more contemporary spaces, but telling a story about the 70s once we're inside that space. I will say, back to the neighborhoods question, though, my parents were young people in Indianapolis in the 70s. They were in their 20s. They met, they fell in love, they got married, and everything happened on the Northwest side, I swear. So they were building the pyramids. St. Vincent's was going up. This was, and again, like right now, we're so focused on kind of density. It's hard to imagine a time when like Northwest Washington Township was the happening place to be, I think, for someone my age.
Well, and that raises the question. I mean, you know, if you can take us back to, we'll pick, maybe not 1970 because we've already talked about that with Unigov, but let's say you go back to 1973 in Indianapolis. What are the biggest differences between life then in this city and life now? We'll start with Ted on that one, but then I want to hear Dan's thoughts as well.
John, you already alluded to it. It would be the skyline.
Yeah.
The skyline, which the, along with it, so I'll be pretty brief on this, which historians rarely do. But along with it, the lack of places to eat,
mm-hmm.
right? So really, it's a commuter downtown. It's a professional downtown. And there isn't really even a convention space that we would recognize today. So many of the things that we think of would just be absent. That's where I would start.
Dan.
And I'll speak for myself. I was born in 66. So I was, you know, a young child in the 70s. But what I remember of downtown is going to the circus, going to the ice show, which all would have been at Market Square Arena, and going to Ayers. But past that, I don't have any memories as a child of going downtown Indianapolis, except save the circle on the during Christmas.
And I should interrupt our conversation just for a second to say that the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Johnson and Shelby counties until 2:10 p.m. Again, the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Johnson and Shelby counties until 2:10 p.m. So if you are in those counties right now, please take appropriate precautions. We have gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Janet who says, and again, if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Janet writes, what do your guests see as a positive legacy of the 1970s and a negative one? Well, I'll start again with Dan on that one. Start with a positive first, and then we'll go to the negative.
A positive, certainly, if you are a sports fan, Indianapolis is what it is today because of the 1970s. Negative is Unigov. Kind of sliced both directions. It created or accelerated maybe some racial tensions in Indianapolis at the time that then had to be sorted out as we went through the years. And perhaps we're still sorting some of those aspects out now.
Ted.
I'll take one that's a wedge that'll do both. Indiana was the last state to ratify the ERA.
Mm-hmm.
And so that demonstrated, and it was a very narrow vote here. So Indiana, Hoosiers can look back with pride on that. And at the same time, the amount of time that it took here, the opposition that began to develop to the ERA ended up providing a blueprint for other states to resist passage of something that looked like it was a foregone conclusion that, of course, this would become a constitutional amendment. So if you're in 1973, everybody assumed that would be a done deal. And so that's the one I would point to.
Leah, since this is exclusively history for you, since you didn't live through it, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who values living in a dense, walkable city, I think a real challenge that was created by the 70s with Unigov is that we do have these outlying areas that stretch our capacity to, you know, pave roads and clear roads and all of that kind of stuff. I think that we're still dealing in an infrastructure sort of way with some of the legacies of 70s. From the positive side, I do think Indianapolis has a very, you know, politically often very creative and collaborative culture. And I think that's also a legacy of the 70s. I think there was some really great leadership here, some people who said, let's try something bold that nobody else has ever done. UNIGOV, let's try that. Let's try building a stadium downtown. Let's try an art strategy and see what happens. And I think that that sort of creativity, we still see that with things like the Cultural Trail or other initiatives here in Indianapolis that I also see as a legacy of the 70s.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Pat. And again, if you want to join the conversation by email, you can do so by sending your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Pat writes, I was in Indy for the start of the 70s and in Terre Haute for college at the ends. Two significant events not yet mentioned. Energy crisis, rising gas prices, pumps that charged by the half gallon because they couldn't charge enough for a gallon. During a coal strike, we had most streetlights dark in Terre Haute and were surprised to see so many lit when visiting family in Indy. And then John Marshall High School mini riot after the outdoor fall pep rally. No large student gatherings for the rest of the school year. A bummer when that was your senior year. I'm guessing, Pat, this means you went to John Marshall. Are either of those included?
I don't think the energy crisis is. I think we just challenged to make that a particularly local story, although when I was asking my parents, what do you remember about the 70s, the energy crisis was certainly part of it because you couldn't go to visit. I think my dad was in grad school in Bloomington at the time. My mom had to be really judicious and share rides to go and visit. I'm curious about the riot. Do you know about that, Dan?
I just learned about the riot yesterday.
Oh, okay.
In doing research for this bar crawl. We won't be representing that particular story, but you may find something along those lines with one of the stories that we're not announcing today, that we have some surprises up our sleeve that we are not sharing until you get to a certain scene.
What caused the riot?
I don't know what caused it, but I do know that city buses were ordered to come pick up and take all the students home. And when things kind of just went ballistic, we'll say, the buses were all ordered to move out. It was quite a mess. One of the gentlemen who's working on the bar crawl was working for the bus system back in the 1970s. So,
well, and do you try to make these more uplifting? Because I'm thinking one of the more traumatic episodes, we just did a show on this not all that long ago, was the whole Tony Caritsas episode. You not familiar with that?
Mm-mm.
Tony Caritsas took Richard Hall hostage,
yeah,
and
on live
television. He's got a shotgun strapped to the guy's head. Everybody in central Indiana is watching this live and wondering whether we're going to see an execution.
We try to avoid guns, fake or otherwise.
We've learned our lesson on
that. We actually did an event a few years ago where we interpreted an FBI raid, and the police had not been informed that we were going to be using fake guns in the street. So, I think we do try to balance uplifting. I don't know, uplifting is quite the right word, but stories that have a quirkiness to them with kind of some serious history. But so far, we haven't done any terrorism-related incidents on bar crawl.
Well, what if you were, other than Tony Caritsas, if you were going to look at something, though, because what I remember of the 70s, and in essence, the 70s were, for me, associated with adolescence, which means by definition, there's a certain innocence. There's also an awful lot of pain and anxiety and all of that goes along with coming of age. If you're going to look at something that was, if not traumatic, at least painful for the community to explore during this, what would it be, Ted?
Well, I would think nationally. So if Pat talked about the energy crisis, you would also say, well, I mean, talk about the hostage crisis. You talk about this era in the 1970s where the optimism of the 60s came crashing to a halt in, say, 68 in the traditional narrative. But, I mean, I would think you would have to get into something like that, which isn't really, though, a local story. And that's the difficulty. And I think these bar crawls do a great job of grappling with the complexity. And at the same time, you know, a public is not going to want to recreate a hostage crisis. And so, but if you get people talking and thinking, that becomes an entry point into a more complex conversation that can continue. And Indiana Humanities does a great job of encouraging those conversations to continue after the event, so it's not just a one-off.
We are talking about the upcoming Naptown Get Down 70s Bar Crawl next week. Here on No Limits, my guests are Ted Franz of the University of Indianapolis' Institute for Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Dan Shockley of the Indiana Historical Society. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the 1970s here on No Limits in anticipation of the upcoming Naptown Get Down 70s Bar Crawl that's sponsored by Indiana Humanities, and you can find information and can register for the event at their website. My guests are Ted Franz of University of Indianapolis' Institute for Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Dan Shockley of the Indiana Historical Society. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Art has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Art, welcome to the program.
Okay. I was going to say, we didn't know it at the time, but in the 1970s, according to David Birch, who was from MIT in the Urban Economics Department, Indianapolis had the greatest increase in entrepreneurship and new business enterprises, had the fastest rate of growth of new startups in its two loop of cities in the United States. And as a result of that, Indianapolis was the first city to take note of that and begin to address the totally lacking venture capital and entrepreneurship infrastructure, in which case human resource firms, law firms, banks, consulting firms, everything that would support Indiana Institute New Business Ventures, Entrepreneurship Alliance, there were an amazing number of entities that were built up to support the continued growth in entrepreneurship, because they saw that as the key path to triggering economic growth and high-quality job creation. Number three, education. The Junior League of Indianapolis, under Carol Garstang, as the volunteer who pioneered this, went out and did a nationwide, I would go out and visit them, see all the various partners in education programs that the Junior League was setting up in other cities. She came back with the best in breed from all of them, and within 3 years, they built up the Indianapolis Partners in Education program to be number one in the United States, which rank they maintained for three additional consecutive years. And that was because of a passion and a desire to create and to contribute and improve our fine city. And last but not least, a massive community needs survey got done in the late 70s, early 80s, which was widely, although silently, applauded, which had been totally created, designed, survey. The survey was done, a community needs survey by the NFJC, is with almost 100 leaders and executives and leaders of all kinds in our society, which produced great fallout that got implemented in the 80s. So I would say it's been and that actually was a continuation of a pattern that was brought to my attention by a fellow volunteer at the Indiana State Museum, an Oxford University grad. Mm-hmm. From a Middle Eastern country, as a matter of fact. He said that pre-World War I Indianapolis was a hotbed of technology development and advanced manufacturing, so much so that it came to the defense attention of Washington during World War I. And after World War I, the government sent people out to study what was special about Indianapolis to see what, if we ever got in a war again, we could do to help support our country.
Well, thanks very much.
Basically, all I had to say.
Great. Thanks very much for the call, Art. So a lot happening, right, Ted?
A lot happening, and I loved that call because in prepping this, you look at public remarks maybe by city leaders, not because they're the most important things that people want to remember, but they give you some indication, in this case, of that entrepreneurial spirit that Art was just talking about. And when Bill Hudnut was inaugurated, he said, "Tonight I challenge you and many who are not here to sign up, enlist, volunteer, become involved, participate, answer the call to serve your city and your fellow man wherever you are in your ordinary vocations and in special ways through special opportunities as they may come to you." And it's not just that he said that, but that so many people did that and wanted to do that and gave of their time, often pro bono. And that would be towards the city, to the state. And I think that's what made Indy so special. And so I really treasure that call.
I should remind everyone that there's been a severe thunderstorm warning issued for Johnson and Shelby counties until 2:10 p.m. So that's about 25 minutes from now. And we want everyone to be safe and take appropriate precautions. We are joined now by Representative Sue Arrington, who's calling in. I guess you're taking part in this event, right, Representative Arrington?
I'm going to be at the stop on the National Organization for Women in Indiana.
Okay. And that has meaning for you, I presume.
Yes. I'm a NOW member, and I was a NOW member in the 70s. That's when I got my introduction to the women's movement, and a lot of it was through the ratification process for the Equal Rights Amendment.
So if you could, take us back to that era. What is something that people just don't get about it now or don't understand?
Well, I think at the time, it was a very exciting time for women to break out of the stereotypes of what we thought limited our vision of what women could be. Mm-hmm. And we started looking at the barriers, and there were a lot of legal barriers, and that's when the movement to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment got started in Congress, and then when they passed it in the early 70s, then it went out to the states for ratification. Unfortunately, we were three states short of what was needed, but Indiana was the last state to ratify that was successful.
And what were you doing as part of that effort?
Well, I was the state coordinator of Indiana NOW, which today we'd call it the state president, but we were looking for new ways of doing things and new language, and so I was state coordinator. And actually, that whole process brought me to the state house for the first time. I had never been to our state capitol until I got on a yellow school bus at the Teachers College in Muncie to come down for a hearing on the Equal Rights Amendment. And I was just a NOW member at that time in Muncie. And that first trip for the hearing, we were all excited. We thought reason would carry the day, but as it turns out, emotion carries the day, and we were unsuccessful that year and the next year. But finally, in 1977, we were able to ratify. And I know people ask me a lot, how did you get started in politics? And I look back to that whole experience of seeing the legislative process and the setbacks. I attended a rally where State Senator Louis Mahern was one of the speakers, and something he said just really clicked for me, and that was, sometimes it's easier to change legislators than it is to change a legislator's vote. And he really had a good point, and there were the Indiana NOW members took it to heart, and as did a lot of other women in the state. But we started looking at the legislative districts, and we knew that it didn't matter in the House if the leadership was Democrat or Republican, because both were supportive of the Equal Rights Amendment. But the Senate was a different story. In order to pass the Senate, it had to be, we had to have Democratic leadership. So that's where we concentrated our efforts, looking at districts that were Republican that could change. And then we've got out and worked for those candidates, and there were enough of them who won that in that year the leadership changed, and so it would start in 1977, and that's when we got the ERA through both the House and the Senate, and the governor was supportive and signed it too.
So in terms of your reenactment of this event, how are you going about doing that, Representative Arrington?
I think, you know, I'll be like Connor Prairie and the Indiana Historical Society, where you go back in time and it's as if we're in 1970 to 1980 all over again. And there were a lot of exciting things that were happening in addition to the Equal Rights Amendment. I'll save that for the tour.
Okay.
But some of it had to do with television and women newscasters. Had a sit-in that at one of the TV stations because there were no women newscasters.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman who was hired not long after that sit-in was Jane Pauley.
Yes, and for someone who was growing up in that era, I remember that she was friends with David Letterman, and he would do a series of pranks over the air, including announcing her engagement to a different guy every week on his rival news stations. That was not quite as famous as, you know, announcing that the hail the size of canned hams was about to fall. or those events. So I probably ought to ask Leah again real quickly, if people, now that Representative Arrington has whetted the appetite for folks who want to come, if they want to come, where do they go to get the information and to reserve tickets?
So, yes, you should visit IndianaHumanities.org, and you'll see a link there for where you can purchase tickets. There are tickets available for both Tuesday next week and Wednesday night. The event is from 6 to 9 both nights. Tickets are $60. That includes a very full menu of booze and heavy hors d'oeuvres throughout the evening. You'll get to meet Sue. She'll be interpreting an older member of the movement, but there will be an actress there interpreting Sue. And I know Dan actually has a document with them. I should say all of the ERA's papers are at the Indiana Historical Society, the NOW chapter's papers at the Historical Society. So we've had a lot of fun digging up and finding Sue in the archives, believe it or not.
And I actually have in front of me a copy of one of your press releases that you wrote on December 8th, 1976, that encourages everyone to come to the announcement of Alice Paul ERA rally and other ERA plans. So we are so excited to have you be part of this. While most of the actors are from the Indiana Historical Society's Museum Theater Department, we've asked Representative Arrington to come in as a guest with us. And really, she was such a big part of this story that she's essentially telling her own story.
And, of course, this is what every person of reasonably mature vintage wants to hear, is that you've officially been designated an historical artifact.
Yes.
just what we love hearing.
I just want to also say I love this story because it's really inspiring to see the persistence of the women's movement in Indianapolis, or Indiana, really, statewide in the 70s. You know, there was a historian who wrote a book about Indianapolis women's movement in the 70s. Her name's Melissa Anna Estes Blair. And, you know, the first kind of movement, there was a march in honor of the 50th anniversary of the women's suffrage movement in 1970. And that was kind of the beginning of that became these kind of other actions. And I found a great quote, that the National Organization of Women actually published a handbook to help women write effective letters to legislators in support of the ERA. And there was a slogan that a letter a day will bring the ERA. And I just, and there was a survey, actually, women before the NOW chapter was founded, the Indianapolis Women's Political Caucus had formed and really pushed Lugar to start a commission on the status of women. And just as one of those statistics I think people would find hard to believe now, their report found that in 1974, 1975, women were 40% of Marion County's workforce, but only 16% of Marion County's government workforce, and 92% of all women who were employed in clerical positions. So that is one of those big changes that women really fought for and made happen.
And I need to interrupt again and say that the National Weather Service has issued a new severe thunderstorm warning for Hamilton and Boone counties. That joins the one that was already in effect for Johnson and Shelby counties. The one for Johnson and Shelby counties is in effect until 2:10 p.m., which is about 15 minutes from now. The one for Hamilton and Boone will last until 2:20 p.m. We've gotten an email from a listener named Matt, who's recalling some memories from the sporting scene here in Indianapolis in the 1970s. He says, positive was the 1972 Indianapolis 500, Mark Donahue, Roger Penske, and beautiful weather. Then says the negative was the 1973 Indianapolis 500, which was rain, death, and mayhem. That was the one in which Art Pollard and Swede Savage and a crew member were killed during that race. And then rain caused the race to be delayed for 3 days, I think it was. That's another part. I mean, do you allude to this in the pub crawl? Because that
not the 500 per se. I think that we're looking at the Pacers. There are some references, so you'll see references to. I mean, this was also the golden age of the ABA Pacers. They won three championships in 4 years
with red, white, and blue basketball.
With red, white, and blue basketballs, and an amazing jump shot.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And Roger Brown, one of the stars on the team, was on the city county council. Right,
yes.
That's like my favorite moment of the 70s. So he guarded Dr. J at night, and then during the day has helped pass city legislation. Right, what a story that is.
Yeah, you really can't talk about sports in Indiana without getting back to basketball sooner or later. But yeah, so I think, and you know, my father is a huge Pacers fan, but he has never really forgiven the NBA for taking away the ABA.
The ABA, I remember seeing those games, coming up to see them. They were actually at what we would call the Pepsi Coliseum now, but we're at the state fairgrounds. Mm-hmm. And then watching them on TV. And I will say, I'm shocked that nobody ever adopted the red, white, and blue basketball, because if you saw it, it just made, particularly if you were up in the nosebleed sections, which is all my friends and I could afford at that time, it just made the ball so much easier to follow. So in terms of this, but there's not a whole lot on the race, because that's the other part of this city in the 70s that I recall, and really up into the 80s, is that, you know, Indianapolis came to a halt during the month of May.
And that's the trick, is there are so many stories of the 1970s that are so, you know, important to me. But then what's, you know, important to me may be a hard sell to the rest of the team, and vice versa. So we have to really work hard to kind of come up with iconic moments that people can really get behind and hopefully then want to learn more about.
And we try to, I
think that'll have to be the last word, because I've got to thank my guest, Ted Franz, Leonamius, and Dan Shockley. Also invite our listeners to stay tuned so that they can listen to NPR's coverage of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony before Congress. And remind the folks in Hamilton, Boone, Johnson, and Shelby counties to take care because of the severe weather. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.